Hello, everybody, and welcome to On Call Me Maybe, a podcast for the monitoring era. I'm your host, Austin Parker.
And I'm Isabel Rettelmeyer, your co-host today.
On Call Me Maybe is brought to you by Lightstep Tracing, the easiest way for teams to adopt best-of-breed distributed tracing. Try it free for 30 days at lightstep.com/products/tracing. And hey, episode one. We're doing the thing. I'm excited.
Welcome aboard.
Yes, welcome everyone to this oral journey through, let's see, what are we going to talk about on this podcast, Isabel?
Let's see, we're going to be talking about general discussions in tech, especially as they relate to reliability, whether that means DevOps or how things can be more reliable for application engineers or security people, just kind of running the gamut there. Then we're also going to be doing some interesting on-call stories. So if you have any, we'd love to hear them.
Yes, and we'll tell you more later about how you can tell us those stories. And finally, I hope we can bring you interesting and insightful interviews with people, let's say luminaries in the world of monitoring and software development. Really, the goal of this is we all, you know, we're all developers here. I'm a software engineer working.
As am I.
Yep. And we're both actually working mostly in open source software. And gosh, wouldn't you know, the hardest thing in the world is just to run reliable software. Maybe it's a little harder to build reliable software. Feels like we're kind of neck and neck, you know? But the more reliable our software is, the easier our jobs get, and the more time we have to spend doing things that aren't staring at, you know, a computer. Or we can stare at the good things in the computer rather than the bad things on the computer.
Yeah, users, turns out, like when things are up, they don't necessarily care how or why. They just like it when they can do the thing that they need to do.
That is true. Well, let's kick it off today with our first segment, and this is a little something I like to call "Stuff I Saw on Hacker News."
It's a good name. Place,
yeah. And first, we're going to look at from InfoQ, I guess they're analysts. They do QCon. That's how I know.
Yeah, they do QCon. So for those who weren't aware or weren't there. QCon London was just this week. I've heard great things. Never actually been myself, but there's been a certain amount of coverage in the Twitterverse, for example.
So a lot of great talks there, and I know that those will be rolling out over the next, I believe, few weeks to months.
I think that they'll become available online in the next few months or so. Prior QCon iterations already have videos online, so I've seen some awesome videos there before.
Yeah, that is one of the cool things. I think one of the things, as a sidebar, like, I really do love how accessible a lot of really great, you know, technical content is from these conferences, and how, you know, it's very open. I feel like you can just go watch stuff on YouTube and learn quite a bit.
Yeah. And just as an example there, one of my favorite QCon videos that I've seen from a prior year was a video by Barbara Liskoff of the Solid Principle, or Liskoff Principle within Solid. Pretty wow. Awesome. Highly recommend checking it out.
Yeah, well, there you go. Something to do for later. So, first piece today, DevOps and Cloud InfoQ Trends Report for February. February, the month that was. I find some of this stuff interesting because it's, I feel like a lot of times if you are a kind of a techie person, you read a lot of blogs, you sit on Hacker News all day, it's really easy to kind of get ahead of yourself in terms of what, you know, what's come out there, what's new, right? Because, you know, I was just thinking like, oh, wow, containers, that's been a thing forever. But when you look at it, like, maybe containers aren't really in use everywhere, and you can certainly go and talk to any number of developers who, you know, they're not developing with containers, they're still running Java apps on Tomcat or WebSphere or whatever.
Good old Tomcat.
Yeah, it's still out there.
Yep. Yes, it is. You can even run it in a container.
Yeah, that's true. And really, I wonder how many containers are just like, oh, we took our Tomcat and we threw it in a Docker container and we put a container. Yo, dog, I heard you like containers. So, key takeaways from this DevOps and Cloud InfoQ Trends report for February. Kubernetes has effectively cornered the market for container orchestration and is arguably becoming the cloud-agnostic compute abstraction.
Yeah. One of the new innovators that they're talking about still is customer reliability engineering. So that's something that I think Google has been pioneering with GCP, where basically the Google SREs will go and help support customer SREs and supplement their SRE team, help them figure out what SLOs to set, help them meet those SLOs, and so on. It's a pretty cool idea. I haven't really personally participated in it from either side, but I'd be pretty curious to do so.
No, me neither. And I think it's really, you know, I'm sure we'll see the CRE book in no time from our friends at Google, but it is interesting. You know, I think that one of the interesting things to me is that we're repackaging a lot of, you know, lessons learned and things in the past for this new, exciting, let's say, cloud native world we live in. And you're starting to kind of see some older concepts be wrapped up in sort of a new coat of paint and a new focus on, I guess, raising it from like, these are things you should do into really a discipline. And I think that's pretty cool. So what else we got?
Yeah, I agree there.
Yeah. What else we got? I think this one's interesting. From their key takeaways, we see that there is a danger of conflating continuous integration and continuous delivery, and also conceptually placing practice and tooling together in the same category. We see applications and services that are being marketed as CI tooling, as within the late majority adoption phase, but best practices here as still within the early majority phase. We also believe that CD practices are in the early majority phase.
Yeah, one thing related to that also that I find interesting is that they consider continuous testing still in the early adopter phase. So pretty curious about what sort of testing or what sort of delivery people do without any sort of automated testing. That feels like a strong prerequisite. And if you are you're doing continuous delivery without any sort of testing, please reach out.
Yes, I would love to talk to you.
And I'm also curious what sorts of on-call stories you have as a result of that.
Yeah, I think it is interesting because and maybe this is one of those things where the buzzwords don't really serve the best needs of people actually having to use this stuff, because CI/CD is, you know, when you think about it, when you see it, it is, you know, the same sentence, but there's a universe of difference, I think, between continuous integration. So you get your CI, you have your automated testing, you have, you know, as much confidence as you could possibly get with automated tooling. And then even at that point, continuous delivery is on the other side of the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like it's really a lot more, I mean, CD in a lot of ways is, maybe I'll put a stake out here and say CD is something that requires radically rethinking how we build software and how we actually iteratively develop software, right?
I agree there. I mean, I think of kind of true CD as basically you deploy to customers every time that you add another commit on master. Essentially, whether that's pushing or merging or what have you, master is always available. It's always what's getting deployed. Now it might be deployed behind a bunch of feature flags or something.
Right. But,
you are not thinking about, should I deploy? It's just happening. And I think that there's a big spectrum between deploying twice a year and that. And I think most people who kind of say that they're practicing continuous delivery aren't necessarily deploying on every commit to master. And I think that's all right.
Yeah. Or, you know, they're deploying to a staging environment, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe not fair to say that's a degraded form of continuous delivery, but it's certainly an interesting distinction. And I think it's something that as sort of these newer technologies, as sort of serverless accelerates and so on and so forth, then I think you're going to see maybe some of the potential in CD get unlocked by further advances in really just how you can run software.
Absolutely.
Last thing off their key takeaways I found interesting was, and I'm quoting now, although a potentially overloaded buzzword in an analyst report, never. Continuing, we are tracking AI ops within the innovator space, and more specifically, the potential value offered by ML for operational insight and alerting. And just to clarify, ML there referring to machine learning. AI, huh?
Yeah, that one is interesting. We get asked about it a certain amount here at Lightstep. And I tend to kind of answer by saying that, like, we have human-based jobs instead, where we have experienced engineers who kind of can anticipate certain patterns and thus programmatically drive rules based on those predictions, basically. So I wouldn't really call that AI. It's just, you know.
Yeah, it's heuristics, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's heuristics and just engineering.
Exactly, which I think lends well into our next story about how 40% of so-called AI startups in Europe actually don't use AI.
Yes, that's a fun one, isn't it? This is in The Verge for March 5th. And I'll just read some of the intro here. Artificial intelligence is one of the most misused terms in tech today, and a new study apparently confirms how hyped the technology has become. According to the survey from London venture capital firm MMC, 40% of European startups that are classified as AI companies don't actually use artificial intelligence in a way that is, quote, material, unquote, to their businesses. MMC studied some 2,830 AI startups in 13 EU countries to come to its conclusion, reviewing the, quote, activities, focus, and funding of each firm. Yeah, in 40% of cases, we could find no evidence of using AI.
Yeah, and I wonder also, like, how even in those 40%, or rather the 60% who allegedly are using AI, how much of that is actually just Mechanical Turk?
Right. Well, there is. So to continue on, I think there, at the end of this article, they do actually say that. Even the ones that did actually have some sort of AI that they were using, it was very banal. A lot of it was chatbots. They had 26% of companies that were just their AI was a chatbot of some sort. And then 21% was fraud detection. I think that...
That makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, both of those... I mean, I think it's reasonable in a lot of ways to question the utility of, you know, a chatbot, right? Like, I know that there are companies that are doing a lot of interesting things in trying to create natural experiences with, you know, chatbots. I think the most interesting ones are also the biggest cautionary tales. Like, I'm thinking like Tay, right? The Microsoft research one that 4chan turned into a Nazi.
I'm not familiar with that one, I don't think, but sounds a little bit
terrifying. No, it's horrible.
And very believable.
Sure. Like, the short version is it was a chatbot that they put on Twitter, and it would, you know, you could interact with it, and it would try to, it would learn, I guess, is the biggest thing, right? So once people figured out that it was kind of learning from input people were getting it, then you know, the usual internet Nazis decided that it'd be a real, you know, for the lulz to make it just absolutely racist and spammed its input so much.
Naturally.
Yeah. And I think that's really, you know, you say, oh, this is an AI, it's an AI. It's like, eh, is it really intelligent or is it, it's regurgitating what people are sending it. And I get that.
Yeah.
So is it RNN, recombinant neural net? I don't know.
Another interesting one there, as far as chatbots go, is the Emacs chatbot, which I believe is Eliza, which apparently has been around since the 60s.
Yes, I remember so that, Eliza.
That very much predates the whole modern ML or AI, but you can just grab it in Emacs. I'm a Vim user primarily myself, so I've not used this. Austin, have you?
I used Eliza as a x86 68K Macintosh program way back in the day because there was an Eliza port for, I mean, I guess it would have been System 6. But yeah, I have not used the Emacs version of it. And there was also, what was it, Smart Child on AOL Instant Messenger? I am dating myself like hell with this conversation, so let's move on. Shall we?
Sorry about that.
No, it's all right. Let's move on to an article in The Guardian. Old technology. NHS uses 10% of world's pagers at annual cost of £6.6 million. More than 1 in 10 of the world's pagers is being used in the NHS. According to estimates, a report looking at communications within the National Health Service said that around 130,000 of the devices were employed at an annual cost of £6.6 million. Pagers, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. My understanding also is that pagers cannot support encryption. So that's a fun one, especially for things like medical care, where, you know, you have all the HIPAA stuff, but meanwhile, unencrypted pagers.
Yeah, I believe actually, I'd have to double check. I think that that's one HIPAA. In the, I mean, this article is about the UK, obviously, and so I don't think they have HIPAA. European listeners will probably write in about that. But I do think in the US, the HIPAA does have some sort of requirement for two-way encryption of any kind of medical data. So I think that that's probably why you don't see a lot of physical pagers in the US anymore for doctors.
Huh. Interesting.
I believe they've all moved.
I like it when my medical data is kept safe myself.
Yeah, no, just from my recollection from talking to people that work in like the EMS space, like the electronic medical records and all that, man, the less you know about what happens at hospitals, the better you are probably. Sounds
absolutely.
Like
and actually, as far as the on-call stuff goes, so tried explaining Lightstep to a friend who's in med school, just finishing up med school now, by explaining it as basically a tool that helps engineers who are on call, since engineers like doctors are on call, and I figured that, you know, the whole on call aspect would kind of resonate with her. So It did, except that it did so in a way that I wasn't anticipating. So she immediately thought about the software engineers who are on call at the hospital.
Oh, okay.
Deal with medical devices at 2 a.m. when they're acting up. So that was not what I was expecting and was kind of terrifying. So now I know to never ask any more questions of any friends who are in the medical profession because I just learned that I don't want to get sick.
That every interaction I've had with medical professionals is basically like, you do you. And if your computer breaks, you should call someone that knows something about that.
Yeah.
Last but not least, Isabel, you found this one.
Yeah, this was a story about how experiments can often be exposed through APIs. So this was a great post by John Liu. John Luca. This was a great post by John Luca, blog.johnliu.ca. So far, he's only published post one, unless post one, two is up. Nope, no, still just part one. So look forward to more. He's gone through some big name companies and found some interesting experiments that can be revealed through their APIs. That the TLDR here, I'd say, is that it's really easy to forget that that even for a web or mobile API that you are not intentionally sharing with external developers, doesn't mean that it's private. By which I mean it's very much not private. Anyone can use it, if browser or phone can. And you know, if you just watch the network traffic going through a web app, for example, you can see a lot of interesting things. So there are all sorts of like fun exploits people have come up with through these, you know, the obvious like SQL injections and stuff, sure, but then also some interesting ones where a while ago people were able to like find a lot of private information about people through like Tinder accounts, for example. I mean, back to this one specifically, you can kind of, in some cases, like toggle which experiments you as a user can see. You can sometimes find interesting business information about things that the company is working on. So if you are, let's say, a competitor or an analyst or investor or something, you can make some fun use of that data, shall we say. But the big thing, I mean, I think one of the kind of most solid solutions to this is just like keeping it out of your web API, essentially. And if that means compiling or building separate versions of your app, for example, the extent that is feasible, certainly presents like caching issues, for example. But mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find I'm really interested in the, apparently they found one on Amazon that was something like augmented reality view. I'm just like, all right, the Fire phone was such a hit. Now, how about the Fire head mounted display? I feel like there's a, as an aside, there's probably room in the market, so to speak, for a tell-all book about the development of the Fire phone called Fire Festival.
Festival of Fire.
Yeah. Really? Yeah, no. But a lot of this is super interesting stuff, and I do wonder, you know, it's always fun to look through that XHR request tab in Chrome. You never know what you're going to see, right?
Yes, indeed. Or Firefox.
Or Firefox, yes.
Shout out to Firefox.
Or my Safari.
Browser. Or Safari, it's true.
Or Opera.
Chromium. Brave.
Yeah.
All sorts of browsers.
There are. And
if you haven't tried Firefox in a long time, you should try it again. Just saying.
I keep thinking about switching back to it, actually. I tried Quantum. Do when it. Was it Quantum? Was that the big rewrite?
Yeah. Do it. Also, if you are listening to this, you may be interested in the developer edition, which gets you the nightly version, but also it looks a bit fancier and stuff. You got a blue logo instead of orange, for example.
That way, easier to find in your dock, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
speaking of continuous delivery, it helps them collect more data sooner about upcoming releases, things like that.
It's true. If you're the type of person to send telemetry back to vendors. So
I could go on.
Yeah, we could, but we only have so much time on this, and I think it's about time that we let everyone take a listen to our second segment today. A couple weeks ago, I had a chance to sit down with Ben Siegelman, who's the CEO of Lightstep, and talk to him about what it was like to work on building monitoring systems at Google, like Dapper, which he was instrumental, I believe, in, and what he's really personally excited about right now in monitoring. So let's go ahead and play that interview for you, and we'll catch you on the other side.
And today I am joined by Ben Siegelman, and at BHS or at LBHS?
Depends on the platform.
Depends on the platform.
I had a Ben Sigelman at GitHub, and then I really wanted BHS, but BHS was like this ghost account that had no repos or commits. Mm-hmm. And then I eventually emailed a friend at GitHub, and I was like, can I have this? And they're like, sure.
It's funny. Twitter names are bad. Like, I don't think you can get like 3-letter ones anymore. Isabel was trying to get a Twitter name yesterday, and I don't know what's the problems. So outside of emailing people at GitHub to get good usernames, what else are you known for?
I don't know. I mean, at this point, I think most people think of me as someone who has opinions about tracing and monitoring and observability, the 6-syllable word that we have to say all the time these days. And I'm also one of the people who was early on in the Open Tracing project and one of the founders at Lightstep, which is a company that builds a monitoring and observability solution that uses a lot of tracing data to, you know, accomplish various things.
Okay. Yeah, and I think a lot of this, you helped, or you authored a paper on Dapper at Google, right?
Right, yeah. It's a bit of a, there's a lot of credit I'm given as the creator of Dapper, and I always protest that because I didn't create the project. I was actually working on ads as a 24-year-old, and they had an event at Google where you opted into this thing where they put you in this 9-dimensional vector space along with everyone else who opted in. And the dimensions in the vector space were like, what office do you work in? What languages do you use? How long have you worked at Google? How long have you been out of school? What's your reporting structure? And then they literally matched you with the person who is the furthest from you in this vector space. Mm-hmm. And then they set up a 30-minute meeting with no agenda. So I did this. And the person they matched me up with when I was working on ads backend stuff was this woman, Sharon Pearl, who's a very distinguished researcher who'd been at Digital when Digital had a great research lab in the 90s and then left with Sanjay Gamawa and Jeff Dean and those sorts of people when Google was just getting going. And she had about 5 projects going, 4 of which I don't remember. And the 5th was Dapper, which was a prototype at that point that she'd built with Luis Barroso and Mike Burrows, who are all 3 of them are much smarter than I am. And she described it to me, and I just thought it was completely fascinating, the idea that you could follow transactions across these systems we had, which we didn't call microservices, but were effectively the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I was, at that particular moment, was reporting to someone who had 120 direct reports, wow. Which is to say he had absolutely no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, how could he, right? I really, you know, with all due respect to the incredible monopoly they've built around ads, I had almost no interest in the product that I was working on, and intellectually, I mean. Mm-hmm. So I just started working on Dapper, and I got it, you know, past a prototype into something that was actually running in production at Google, mm-hmm. and then made some changes to the project and the way that we built it and the terminology and so on and so forth, and did ultimately write a paper about it, which was rejected by every conference we ever sent it to this day. We ultimately published it as a technical report because no one else would publish it. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, people have actually read this paper, which is marvelous, but still surprises me to this day. But I suffered a lot to get Dapper into production. That was an act of suffering, but I can't take credit for actually inventing the thing. I will admit that I recognized how awesome it was, but I wish I could have actually been the one to have conceptualized of it in the first place.
Well, you know, and what's interesting is I think Dapper was what, 2008-ish? I mean, the paper came out.
The paper was put online in 2010,
yeah.
Because someone needed to cite it. That's why we did it, is that someone else wanted to write an actual academic paper, and they wanted to cite it, and they realized it wasn't there. And I was like, well, that's because it didn't get accepted at any conference.
Right.
And so they put it online in 2010. But that was a paper that had been submitted in 2008 and rejected, and that was a revision of a paper in 2006 that had been submitted and rejected. And we actually started working on the project in 2004.
Wow.
So the project was really, as described in the 2010 paper, was really from the 2006 paper. And the 2006 paper was also a little bit backdated in terms of technology. So what we were actually doing with Dapper is also informed by a bunch of lessons that weren't recorded in that paper, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing when you think about it, because we're, you know, 2019.
15 years, yeah.
15 years. And that's, you must have a fascinating perspective on, you know, how things have changed since then between what Google was doing and kind of what the industry is doing today.
I do have a perspective on it. Yeah. I mean, the problems we were solving at Google at the time were largely of our own creation. And so it was difficult to find off the shelf. I don't mean just off the shelf, like you could buy it, but in 2004, GitHub didn't exist. I mean, literally, you know, the closest thing we had was the GNU project and stuff, which I'm not saying is a good or a bad thing, but it is of no use for something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Hadoop and company were starting to emerge around those times, but it was still very early days. So we had to build everything in-house. And the emphasis for Dapper was really on just regaining some kind of observational footing, just something. I mean, at the time, it was pretty daunting to try and make sense of these systems that we had built. We had some mechanisms to do it, but it was very, very primitive. And mm-hmm. a lot of the things that we've seen outside of Google, like the cardinality problem with metrics and the data volume problem with logs, had started to bite us by that point. So
right.
there were real pain points there. But as is often the case when you're solving a problem that hasn't been written about previously, in retrospect, what you did had lots of, like, you know, in retrospect, obvious shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the decisions we made with Dapper that we didn't even debate in retrospect involved assumptions that were completely incorrect, and I have a ton of regrets about it. So one of the advantages of doing it all over again now is that we have the benefit of hindsight to, you know, that time at Google, and there are so many different companies that are hitting the same problems at the same time that you can really spot the issues that are fundamental and the issues that are more an artifact of some other oddity.
Mm-hmm.
Like at Google, there are a lot of oddities just in the way they built their systems, and some of those informed Dapper's design and have affected the design of tracing systems today and really don't generalize well. I can get more specific if you'd like, but Dapper's design really only made sense for Google, and it's a bit ironic to me that it's taken so much hold in the industry mm-hmm. as a design, because it's not, in my mind, the right thing for most enterprise software companies.
Well, I mean, maybe what is the right thing, right? There's been quite a bit of work done, I feel like, in the community through kind of standards building in either the W3C or just independently to solve problems like context propagation, right? Being able to pass a trace from system A to system B or pass a span. You know, what other sort of, I guess if you had to do it over, right? If you had to say this is the one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head in a way. It's just that there were three or maybe four different problems that we'd convolved into one with Dapper. And we didn't realize that we were doing that at the time. But you said it already, the context propagation problem, which has nothing to do with timing. It has everything to do with causality. Like, you need to know what causes what, but you don't need to know the timing. That problem is really essential. And I won't go in for the, you know, in the interest of not putting our listeners to sleep, I won't go into the details of how we did that at Google, but that's a problem unto itself and probably deserves special treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't think we'll probably get to that point with this iteration in industry. The second problem is doing the timing. Mm-hmm. It probably makes sense, just so we don't overwhelm people, to do the timing and the context propagation all in one, which is where the idea of a span comes from.
Right.
So people have critiqued spans, I think totally rightly, by saying, you know, we're convolving timing and tagging with context propagation, and they're correct.
Mm-hmm.
I would respond with the fact that, you know, people want to get to a value prop pretty quickly, and by throwing additional abstractions at them in the instrumentation phase, you're making that harder. Most people want something like Dapper in order to do performance analysis, so a span is really an optimization to make it easier to do performance analysis,
right.
And that's the reason why we've settled on spans as an industry. But that's still, we're just talking about instrumentation and having the software be self-describing. So that's an entire problem. And it really needs to be, I don't say it should, but it must be separated from the rest of the problem, because there are many ways to use that description, that self-description, beyond performance analysis, and to couple the performance analysis solution to the instrumentation is like it's a needless tax you're putting on future efforts to exploit that instrumentation for other purposes. So I think that needs to be separate. Then there's the problem of data collection and centralization, which is something that we dealt with at Google really with one giant hack, which was to do random sampling. That's certainly an approach and something that Zipkin and many other open source tracing systems have followed with. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing. It does have a trade-off, but there are many ways to approach the data collection problem. And again, that's a separate concern that doesn't have a right answer. If you're a small shop that does small request volume, you probably should just keep every single trace. There's no reason not to. If you're some giant, giant company that can't accept any latency overhead or any throughput overhead, then you probably need to do some kind of sampling. Right. And then there's a whole spectrum of things in between that, depending on your use cases, that may or may not be appropriate. But we need to maintain optionality and not assume that there's one right way to do it, because it depends entirely on the scale of the use cases. And then the final thing is just that. It's like, what value are you actually getting from this data? And with Dapper, all we really allowed you to do was to do a pretty trivial parametric search of trace data and then to look at traces. Nothing wrong with that. That's valuable in its own way. But in terms of exploiting the value of the traces is just the tip of the iceberg. And I think that people often confuse looking at an individual trace with the value of distributed tracing. Distributed tracing is a data source. It is not in and of itself a solution. Like, you need to think about what problem you're solving and whether or not that data can be incorporated into the solution. But the number of people that that equate the sort of presentation of a single distributed trace with the value prop for distributed tracing.
Right.
I mean, it's most people who think about distributed tracing. That's mostly what people are thinking about. And I would argue that in a couple of years, we'll look back and realize that was actually one of the least valuable things we got from distributed tracing. And Dapper, unfortunately, helped a lot with that misunderstanding.
Yeah. I mean, on that point, I guess, you know, I know you've talked about moving beyond, to step back a second, there's this three pillars, right? Where it's metrics, logs, tracings. And I know you've talked about kind of moving beyond that concept. How do we conceptualize that next generation of, you know, monitoring and building, or I guess operating software reliably, sorry. What is next? Like, is there, from where you're standing?
That's a really good question. I do sometimes critique the three pillars. I think all three of them, metrics, logs, and tracing, are valuable, but not as pillars. They're more like pipes. I think those are the three pipes that you need to build some kind of, you know, actual solution out of, whatever that is. I like thinking about it in terms of service teams. The reason that people adopt microservices now, at least the reason they should adopt microservices, is managerial. It's about allowing a team of developers, or DevOps, or whatever you want to call them. I mean, I'm agnostic about the terminology, but you want a team of people writing code to be efficient,
right,
and to be autonomous, and to deploy with independence. And it's also, as part of that, it's about reducing the need to communicate with other teams. And it's worked beautifully in that regard, except that there are times when you realize, despite the fact that you don't know what they do, you still depend on the team that's three layers below you, especially when their service isn't working. So the struggle, I think, for people who are trying to make sense of observability and the three pillars is that they think they immediately start thinking about these data types and how we visualize and interact with them as data types. So you end up with things like, you know, log search, even structured log search, metrics dashboards, individual traces, that sort of stuff, because we're thinking about the raw data, when we probably ought to go back to the operational aspects of these services themselves and focus more on what those teams actually need. I like the Google SRE book, not all of it, but I like most of it. And I definitely like the part of it that talks about SLIs, SLOs, and SLAs. So the idea, if you aren't familiar with it, is that every service in your system needs to have service level indicators, which basically parameterize its health, and then objectives for each one of those indicators. And most services probably only have a handful of them that actually matter. So, you know, think like 3 to 5 key kind of latency and reliability indicators for a service. My personal opinion is that we should reframe all of the observability around that. So you've got your services, you have your health indicators, and then all of these data sources, metrics, logs, tracing, whatever, are used to inform your understanding of those indicators and where they're headed, including your dependencies on other systems. So the tracing data becomes vital for that, but it's not about looking at traces in a UI. It's actually about gluing together all these services and helping people understand how one SLI affects another. And metric data can be helpful to, you know, reveal why a particular container is having CPU saturation and that is affecting your SLI in this way.
Yeah.
But I don't think it should start with a conversation around the metrics or the logs or the tracing. It should start around the services, their SLIs, and then a principled analysis of how various system behaviors affect those SLIs.
There's a sort of cargo cultiness, right, in around a lot of stuff that Google has done. And I know that maybe some of the concepts out of like the SRE book, like they're extremely valuable to organizations at Google scale. You know, how do we kind of as an industry make that sort of, is it about monitoring companies, about people that are working in this space, making it easier to define those SLOs and really, like, are we attacking the problem the wrong way? We're saying, here's this tool. And you can plug your data, you can pipe your traces, your metrics, your logs into these tools and use those to gain some insight. But are we attacking the problem kind of from the wrong direction?
I think so.
Yeah.
Personally, I mean, it's not that I don't think that people should have access to the raw data or that they should be restricted from building whatever they want with it. I mean, ideally, whether you're building with open source or buying from a vendor, you should have APIs that allow you to do that. But I think the tools in terms of UX and UI, what they present to people, I would like them to take a more progressive and opinionated stance to help people avoid anti-patterns that are very easy to slip into. And for what it's worth, I'm very, very quick to criticize Google. Despite the fact that I like that book, there are a lot of teams, a lot of SRE teams at Google that would have really benefited from reading it. I mean, there were a lot of teams. When I worked on Monarch, which was actually a larger and longer project than Dapper was for me at Google, that was Google's big, you know, highly available time series database.
Right.
And so I had to work with a couple of hundred SRE teams as my customers, basically, for that project, especially early on when we were trying to figure out exactly what we were building. And so I did a survey of how they constructed their monitoring. And there were things that I saw that were so elegant and beautiful, and I still reference them in, you know, today, and things I saw that were just truly shocking. And, you know, this is for products that we rely on or that I rely on as a consumer today.
Sure, sure.
People create these monstrously complicated ways of observing these systems that, you know, bedeviled everyone who touched them. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's because they got addicted to seeing signal. And so they would generate UX that emphasized all of the possible signals without recognizing that there are more of them than a human being can possibly perceive. So there's, I don't like the signal and noise metaphor because it's not that it's noise, it's just too much signal. That's
right.
Really the way I would put it. And I think that's where a lot of the current tooling leads you. It leads you in the direction of dashboards that are just pages and pages of metrics that may be of some value to you in an investigation, but in any real incident, they'll all be read at the same time. And so it's actually pretty overwhelming.
I think, you know, a lot of people are looking at this volume of data that modern systems are capable of generating, saying like, machine learning, right? You know, that's going to save us. Do you have a really an opinion on that either way?
Yeah, I mean, definitely heard that pitch a million times too. I'm consider me a deep skeptic about AI and machine learning in the world that we're all traveling in, at least the way it's being marketed right now. I won't name names, but I've seen a lot of products that are taking what, in my mind, is like AP statistics, or maybe not even AP statistics, and then marketing it as AI.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, I have Google Photos on my phone. That's AI. Like, I don't know how it's, you know, finding pictures of my wife when she was 3 years old on my phone and knowing it's the same person as the person in the photo from last week. I mean, it's incredible that they can do that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's something really impressive that's powering all of that. It's a lot more than building a histogram, which is what people are calling machine learning right now.
Yeah. So on that topic, you know, in kind of the monitoring space and sort of this SRE space, you know, can you tell me about something you're really personally excited about right now? Maybe an open source project or some upcoming technology?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, there's so many. I'm always excited about open tracing, but that's personal bias. I won't talk about that one. And nevertheless, I'll admit that I'm excited about it. It seems to be, for whatever reason, it's the thing that someone needed. Service mesh is the thing that our industry needed in order to stop trying to solve some really hard computer science and engineering problems as one-off hacks.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are things like circuit breaking and service discovery and things like that that we've been running up against for ages and have been trying to hack at for ages. And finally, service mesh seems to have done the job of convincing people that that's actually a really hard problem that should be delegated to a dedicated project.
Mm-hmm.
gRPC or things like it could also be of value there in the future, but it seems like the adoption curve for service mesh has overtaken it. So I'm excited about the technology, but more than anything, I'm excited about the fact that we finally have a single well-factored place to do a lot of difficult things like authentication, circuit breaking, load balancing, monitoring, that sort of stuff. I think that's really powerful for the transition away from monolithic architectures.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's about all we have time for today. So I'd like to, I mean, before we go, do you have anything you kind of want to plug or?
Oh, not really. No, this has been really fun.
Yeah.
If people have questions for me, going back to the beginning of the program when we're talking about getting PHS at GitHub, I also made the profound mistake of getting PHS at gmail.com. You're welcome to reach out to me there, although I'll warn you that I get spammed. Well, it's not even really spam. It's not commercial messages, but I get invited to lots of soccer games and things like that for various B high schools across the country. But I like getting an occasional message that's actually meant for me as well. So feel free to reach out if you have questions about any of this stuff. I love chatting with people.
Yeah, awesome. I feel like that would be a good travelogue. Go to all those B high school soccer games. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope we can catch up again when I'm back out west.
Sounds good. All right.
Thank you.
So it occurs to me that we've been talking for a little while, but we haven't really spoken about being on call yet. And as you can guess from the name of our podcast, on call is something that we care about.
It is. So do you have any good on call stories?
I don't have any myself. Actually, true confession, I've never been paged. Just more by luck than by engineering brilliance.
That's shocking.
The secret is to just like avoid being in the critical path of things.
Yeah. Does that make us some kind of like poser podcast where we're talking about on call, but we've never been paged?
Yeah.
I've been paged, actually. I have a fun story about this. It was from my time before I really got into development. I was working in IT for kind of the early part of my career, and I was working as a telecom manager for a global company. And I worked in the headquarters, and I managed everyone's cell phones, basically. We had, the organization was several thousand people, and there were, you know, maybe 1,000 cell phones or something as part of that. And this was pre-iPhone, but it was early iPhone days. So, of course, everyone's using BlackBerries because that's what you used, unless you were in real estate and then used Palm Treo because that had an app to let you get into a lockbox on a house. But so one night, it was like a Friday, Saturday, I don't know. I was not anticipating on working, so I had gone out and was, you know, enjoying myself. And I get back home and my phone rings, and it's the executive assistant of the CEO and president of the company who is telling me that he just landed in India somewhere and his BlackBerry doesn't work. And we needed to fix that. But there was, and so she was calling from there. And there were, I think, four or five people from the company had gone, and they were in the middle of nowhere. I don't even know, I do not know India well enough to know how middle of nowhere it was, but I was being informed they were way out in the boonies. They were like the airport they landed at was literally a landing strip and like a shack or something, right? And a little tower. So I call AT&T, and I'm trying to explain the situation to them. And we eventually bridged through like four or five other departments and various things until someone manages to get effectively a knock on call person at the central office for this particular region of the country to like see what was going on. And it turns out that the cell tower they were close to was configured in such a way that there was a very limited amount of room for registrations for GSM roaming. And there were just enough people with these BlackBerries, like there was exactly one person too many. And by the luck of the draw, the CEO's phone was the one that stopped working. And the only real solution was because they were like, hey, can you, like, we can't really provision anything more to it. That's just the card that's on there. That's the config. There's no way to remotely flash it. So my response was like, well, someone needs to turn off their phone. And one other person turned off the phone, and wouldn't you know it, his just right back up.
That sounds brutal.
Yeah, that was really fun to do while I was drunk as heck. But it was an interesting experience, let's say. And it was one of the many reasons that I decided I didn't want to work in IT anymore, because software problems feel like they're easier to diagnose sometimes, or at least require less human intervention to diagnose.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But that's enough about me. What we really want to hear, I think, are your on-call stories. So please tweet them to us. You can tweet us at OnCallMeMaybe on Twitter, or you can email stories to stories at OnCallMeMaybe.com.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you.
We would. So I think that's all we got time for today.
Thanks for listening.
Yep. If you're listening to this, please like and subscribe and do all that good stuff. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on iTunes. You can find us on Google Podcasts, on your Android phone, and we are on Spotify.
Yeah. So, talk to you next time,
everyone.